mention. Mr. Kirshner?
May it please the court, my name is Bob Kirshner. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Al Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell, in February of 1994, filed suit pro se in the Central District of Illinois, complaining that his free speech rights had been violated by administrators at the University of Illinois and by a professor at the University of Illinois as a result of the termination of funding for a publication he had been responsible for almost two decades. Mr. Mitchell's complaint at that time alleged that the funding was terminated because Oasis Graphics, the publication, had written and published articles critical of Dr. Fellner and a project that Dr. Fellner was engaged in. When Mr. Mitchell filed that suit, it was timely filed. He filed it against four named defendants, administrators and a professor at the University of Illinois, based upon assurances and representations from his department supervisor, who was Mr. Rappaport, Julian Rappaport, that the funding was terminated because of Mr. Fellner and because of the criticism that had been rendered in the publication against Dr. Fellner. Mr. Rappaport, Julian Rappaport, told my client that he had fought to keep the funding, but it was the committee, which were the four people sued, that had opposed that and had overruled that decision. By March of 1995, that motions to dismiss were resolved, and Mr. Mitchell had counsel, not myself, but other counsel appear on his behalf and then subsequently withdraw. In March of 96, substitute counsel entered an appearance, and a discovery plan was filed in May of 1996. The defendants in that litigation then moved to disqualify counsel for Mr. Mitchell on the basis that an employee, another lawyer in the office, had previously worked in the vice chancellor's office. That was resolved in April of 1998.
Mr. Kirshner, let me ask you a specific question, if I may. What did Donchin do or say that caused Mr. Mitchell to miss the limitations period? I understand the Rappaport argument.
The evidence in the record and the testimony and the depositions that were taken indicate two potentially conflicting situations. For example, the testimony, and this is at page 4 of the reply brief, which documents the record citation, Donchin gave, quote, hell about the articles being published and questioned, Donchin specifically questioned, whether the university should fund a publication that was critical of one of its professors.
Right, but why would that cause Mr. Mitchell to miss the limitations period?
There is not a direct representation from Donchin to Mitchell as there was from Rappaport to Mitchell. It is Donchin and Rappaport's association and Donchin's apparent, if you believe some testimony versus others. For example, Vice Chancellor Birdall testified that it was really Donchin's decision to terminate the funding, not Rappaport's. And this is at page 6 of our reply brief. Vice Chancellor Birdall said that Rappaport's involvement carried a lot of weight, but it was Donchin who approved the termination. Tina Gonzalez, who was one of the original defendants, also attributed to Donchin the decision to terminate the funding and said that he was very angry that there had been a publication critical of a professor at the university that the university was paying for. Because of the relationship between Donchin and Rappaport, Donchin being the department head, Rappaport being the department liaison to Oasis Graphics. Rappaport's representation, which specifically excluded from liability and excluded from involvement both he and Donchin, That's the basis on which Donchan is involved in this case, although I would concede for equitable estoppel purposes, we don't have the same direct representations with Donchan that we do with Rappaport. But equitable tolling is different. And with respect to equitable tolling, this court has previously pointed out that it is intended to strike a balance between an innocent defendant
But there's some requirement of diligence and energy here. Why would any sensible person take at face value Rappaport's denial of responsibility? Nothing's more common. If you accuse someone of having done something to you, the person always says, oh, it wasn't me. I fought for you. It was a bad guy who did something. That should get you investigating. Now, you don't just accept that.
Rappaport had been the individual that had hired and engaged my client to head up this program. They had a relationship expanding nearly two decades. Rappaport comes to my client and says it was Fellner who's responsible for this. Now, in context, which the court must consider, I believe, Fellner was the professor that the article was critical about. It made perfect sense that the criticism of Fellner in the article would have been the basis for the termination of funding, in part for the reasons I've already articulated, but in part for another very important reason. At the exact same...
You said Rappaport was the liaison to this publication, so you think a prudent person who knows he's been injured investigates the potential injurers, which could certainly include Rappaport.
Your Honor,
otherwise, you're not going to have any statute of limitations anymore, because this is equitable estoppel, then any time someone denies liability, you're going to call that equitable estoppel.
Your Honor, there was more than a mere denial of liability. In February of 1994, just a few weeks before suit was filed, against four individuals, not Rappaport and Donchan, against four other individuals that Rappaport said were responsible, just two weeks before, Rappaport physically went with my client to look for new space, new and expanded space, for the operation of Oasis Graphics. He was personally involved in developing a new layout for the continuation of the operation.
Well, had you deposed Rappaport?
Rappaport was deposed in November of 1998.
Back when the suit against the other four was filed, had Rappaport been deposed?
That was the suit in which he was deposed, Your Honor, in November of 98. The suit was filed in February of 94. Motions to dismiss were resolved in...
To be clear, when was the suit filed against the four?
February of 94.
Well, Rappaport hadn't been deposed then, had he?
No, November of 98.
I know, but my question was, when the suit was filed against the four, why hadn't Rappaport been deposed?
There was no vehicle in which to take a deposition, Judge.
What do you mean, no vehicle? What? What are you talking about?
Suit was originally filed in February of 94.
Yes, but what... Okay, so suit is filed... I'm sorry, all right. Suit is filed in February 94 or something... And then depositions are taken.
And Rappaport is finally...
Why did it take 4 years to depose Rappaport?
Because motions directed to the pleadings were resolved in March of 95. Mr. Mitchell then obtained counsel from Chicago, who subsequently withdrew. Substitute counsel entered an appearance March of 96. A discovery plan was filed 2 months later. The four named individuals, then substituted counsel, then there was a motion to disqualify Mr. Mitchell's attorney, and that motion to disqualify was finally resolved in April of 98, within 7 months of that resolution, so the case could then proceed. Mr. Rappaport was deposed. Within months after his deposition, the predecessor suit was dismissed by agreement of the parties. This action was initiated within 60 days after the other action was dismissed. voluntary.
Well, what was the interval between Rappaport's deposition and the filing of the new suit?
Rappaport's deposition was November of 1998. This suit was filed, I don't remember the exact date, but I have a file mark on the pleading, I can tell. It was within 60 days of the prior action being dismissed, Your Honor.
When? Well, if you can't find it, forget it.
The complaint was filed August 5th of 1999.
Well, that's quite an interval between when you discovered that Rappaport was the villain and when you decided to sue him.
The
9 months.
The prior action, Your Honor, was dismissed June 2nd.
Why did it take 9 months to sue him? With the statute of limitations running the way it is, you're supposed to act promptly, we keep saying in our cases.
During that intervening period, the transcript was received, a determination had to be made whether to dismiss the four people.
It didn't take 9 months to decide whether to add Rappaport as a defendant.
He wasn't added as a defendant, Your Honor. There was a separate suit filed after the...
Well, whatever it does, it doesn't take 9 months. When the statute of limitations is running, you're supposed to act promptly.
Appendix to the brief, Your Honor, is the docket sheet from the prior action in which there is disclosure of the effort made to add Rappaport to that suit, the district court's refusal to do so, and then a dismissal. Appendix to our original brief. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kirschner. Mr. Klaus?
Good morning. I represent Professors Julian Rappaport and Emmanuel Donchin. This appeal is the latest event in a long history, which began back in March of 1992. In March of 1992, the record is undisputed that Professor Rappaport told Mr. Mitchell that the OASIS graphics program would be terminated. Mr. Mitchell asked for, from Professor Rappaport, and received an additional year to run the program, which the program was then ultimately terminated in 1993. A year later, the first 1983 action was filed.
Well, then why is he looking for new space for him?
Your Honor.
I mean, if he's told them a year before.
No. I believe Mr. Kirchner misspoke when he was talking about the timing of when they were looking for the space. They were looking for space in February of 92, not February of 93 or February of 94. They were looking for new space. I would say that's actually totally natural as opposed to something pernicious. What was going on was an evaluation of whether or not this program would continue. That by everyone's testimony, the facility in which OASIS Graphics and the daycare center that was part of this community psychology program was being run was run down. And there was an evaluation system going on within the university about whether or not to take new space. And this was in the context of a fiscal time with the state where there was a large budget deficit. There was a seven-figure budget deficit within the Department of Psychology itself. And so a decision was made by Professor Rappaport, of course, in consultation with Dr. Donchin, who was the head of the psychology department, to close the daycare center and OASIS Graphics, redirect the funds to hire a social worker, an MSW, to liaison with the African-American community, and to use the excess funds to reduce the department budget.
What was the rationale used in denying the amendment of the original complaint to add Mr. Professor Rappaport?
Your Honor, again, as Mr. Kirchner said, I came into the case after the motions to dismiss were done. The previous counsel for the defendants was elected to the state court. But I do not believe that at any point in the preceding Section 1983 action that there was actually a motion to amend to add either Professor Rappaport or Dr. Don.
Contrary to what your opponent says?
I'm sorry, I did not hear him make that argument.
Oh, I'll ask him when he gets back up. But I understood him to say that they sought to amend the original complaint by adding Rappaport that was denied and then the cases were dismissed.
Obviously, the record would speak for itself. I do not remember that occurring, certainly while I was counsel for the...
Well, it was an agreed dismissal in any event.
It was an agreed dismissal. It was filed... Dr. Rappaport was deposed almost 5 years after the original case was filed. 6 months after that, I filed a motion for summary judgment in the first case, asserting that, first and foremost, there was no evidence that the speech of Mr. Mitchell had any bearing or was a factor in the decision to terminate the funding. And second, that the statute of limit, or I'm sorry, I filed a motion for summary judgment in the underlying case on the merits of the statute of limitations. Obviously, it had nothing to do with the first case. 3 days after the filing of that summary judgment, the parties did enter into a Rule 41 stipulation to dismiss that case.
I gather there was 6 months from the time of the deposition of Rappaport until the dismissal.
Correct, Your Honor. That is correct. And 2 months later, as Mr. Kirchner represented the court, and this is accurate, this case was filed on August 5th, 1999, which would be 8 to 9 months after Dr. Rappaport was deposed.
Mr. Klaus, why should we assume that Dr. Rappaport would have told the truth if he had been deposed before the statute of limitations ran out? He had already lied once, it would seem, to save himself from being sued.
Well, I'm stuck with the disputed fact in this case. As I indicated in the brief, we don't obviously concede the earlier representation. Your Honor, that's the risk. I can't speak for the events that occur. That's the risk that occurs in any case in discovery, that someone will not be forthcoming in discovery. I've been a lawyer too long now to tell the court that people don't lie under oath. Unfortunately, it occurs. But I would suggest that Dr. Rappaport's deposition is not the trigger for the knowledge that, at any rate, that what occurred was is that the beginning or the decision to cut off funding for this program began in the Department of Psychology as opposed to somewhere else because of some outside pressure. There are documents, there are other people's testimony wherein they said that the decision to cut this funding originated out of psychology by Dr. Rappaport and then through Dr. Donchin.
But so as you say, you're stuck with the, you know, the facts that you're stuck with. And Dr. Rappaport, under those facts, didn't simply deny he was liable or deny he was involved. You know, he affirmatively misrepresented who made the decision, which led Mr. Mitchell to sue the wrong plaintiff. Why isn't that enough for equitable estoppel against Dr. Rappaport?
Well, I would answer that question two ways. First of all, the first part of it, which is the issue of the mere denial, is one half of the equation. But the other half, and I'll speak to that, but the other half of the equation is not just the affirmative step. That's only one half of the equation with respect to equitable estoppel. But the other half is justifiable and reasonable and actual reliance. And as the court pointed out and as was discussed, Dr. Rappaport hired Mr. Mitchell 20 years before. Mr. Mitchell made very clear that he understood that Dr. Rappaport was his direct superior. He made very clear that if he needed something, if he needed equipment, if he needed assets, the money for that came from Dr. Rappaport's budget. When the time came for him to ask for an extra year so that he could wind down this program, he asked Dr. Rappaport. So it is not credible for there to be an argument that there was reasonable reliance upon this, if you will, misdirection or alleged misdirection, because it is only credible that Mr. Mitchell knew that Dr. Rappaport was involved up to his ears in the program, it was his program, and that he had to have some act in the determination that the budget would be cut.
But obviously they were close friends.
I think that's true, and I can go farther than say I think that's true. The record supports that. They both testified to that. Your Honor, that may well be true, but I don't know that it ultimately answers the question of reliance. Not with all of the other facts that are involved, and the fact that he knew from long practice that this was Dr. Rappaport's program. And I would say that if anyone who is associated with the university for any period of time would know that professors rarely, if ever, readily give up their funding for particular programs unless it's their own idea. I see that my time is up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cross. Mr. Kirshner, does he have any time? Oh, well, if you want a minute to rebut, you may have it. Do you have something else?
I thought my time had expired, but two very quick points. The docket sheet A49 of the appendix reflects on 4-5 of 99 a conference with Judge Nim and counsel of record in this case. Beginning with that, Judge Nim indicated that he would not permit an amendment to join Dr. Rappaport in that previously filed litigation.
Did he say why?
Because the case was set for trial and he wasn't going to add another plaintiff 5 years after the original filing. Or another defendant. Another defendant. With respect to the looking for space, I didn't misspeak, but maybe I wasn't clear. In February of 92, Dr. Rappaport, my client, and the others with Oasis Graphics looked for new space, had layouts, had architects design new space. Dr. Rappaport was part of that, February of 92. Within weeks of that, Dr. Rappaport said, the funding is being terminated, Fellner's behind this, I know he's behind it. It was after the termination that my client asked for a year to wrap up the operation. That took it to 93, and that's what Mr. Foss is referring to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. Last case for argument.